And it says there's just four attendees. Ali Ramlawi is having technical difficulties and expects to join us in about five minutes, and he's chairing the meeting this evening. Hello, Jim and Juliet, I see your hand up.
Yes, are we supposed to be seeing your face yet or not? Because all I'm getting is a blank screen.
Oh, okay. Are you seeing my name?
I can hear your voice. That's about it. It's really, seriously, just a blank screen. I can go out and try and come in again.
You might want to do that because I can see myself and then I can see all the other attendees with their hands up. Let's see, Sam has his
hand. I can see you, Kathy. I can see you just fine, just to let you know.
Okay.
I'll try again.
Must be on your end, Juliet.
Okay.
Yeah. Juliet, can you see the screen now?
I cannot.
Oh.
Yeah, I can't figure this out because we use this for Zooms all the time, so I'm not quite sure what's going on. But I can hear you, so I guess it's just like being on the phone, only better.
Maybe log back in?
Well, I just went out and came back in, so that didn't fix it.
I'm no expert.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's for sure.
Well, I have a proposal and I'd like to get feedback from the people that are here, and that is taking a break from caucus until September and then reconsidering it. Without caucus, we would still be available to our constituents and also available to meet in small sub-quorum groups as needed on specific topics. Does anyone here have a strong opinion one way or the other?
If you are meeting, we will make the attempt to watch. We've missed the last several, but if you're not meeting, we'll just muddle through, I guess.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm trying to think of some ways that we could have the positive aspects of caucus without the overhead and the need for people to come together on a beautiful Sunday afternoon.
Sure. Certainly open to alternatives.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is Blaine Coleman, and I wanted to speak about the resolution against military aid to Israel.
Oh,
I'm looking for a council member to introduce it, yes.
Oh, okay, Blaine, we're waiting for Ali to arrive. But the question that I did ask is whether people would prefer to continue meeting for caucus over the summer or prefer to take a break for the summer. Understanding that there will be other opportunities to communicate and interact with council members and for
unmuted
council members to meet.
Yeah. Well, of course, everybody wants a break. However, I think that the public can access meetings a lot better if there are meetings. That goes for council meetings. It goes for caucus meetings. Mm-hmm. So it is more work for you. It's more of a pain in the butt for you guys. But I think it really does increase our access. That's what I think.
Oh, okay.
And I honestly think that Ann Arbor City Council has really turned its back on the public. If you guys want to be known for a bunch who actually doesn't give a fuck about the public, go ahead and cut out.
You are muted.
Kathy?
Sam, did you have something to say?
Yeah, I know I haven't attended as much as I could have or as much as you've attended, so thank you for doing this. And I think, as you brought up at some meetings, I want to agree with Blaine, I guess, I'll have to say. I think it is important and thank you so much for doing this. And even if you have low attendance, sometimes it really shows that some people on council are being accessible and are listening to constituents. So even if you don't feel appreciated, know that you're appreciated. And I haven't attended every council caucus, but I think it's very important to do. That's my two cents. I realize it's a lot of work and the Zooms are some expense, but thank you for doing it. And I think it's important. So hopefully that's some encouragement, and I respect either decision you make. It will be much easier once we're in person, so.
Yes, that is true, and that's scheduled for this fall, is based on what we know right now. So, okay, thanks. Lisa?
Am I in? Or?
Yes, you. I can see your name, but I can't see your face.
Oh.
I can't see anyone's face but
my own. Are you sure you let me into the meeting?
Yes, I did. Let's see here more. Okay.
Because I don't have a camera thing. I don't have an icon.
Actually, Kathy, that's true for us, too. We've got the mute, but we don't have the camera.
Okay. Okay, Lisa. I can see you now.
Yes, yay! I was only raising my hand to ask to be let in.
I think everything changed. I can see myself now. I don't know if that's good,
yes.
But I can.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I see all of you now, too. Before, the only one I saw was Kathy.
Okay, and Lisa, Ollie is back with us now. Okay. Welcome back, Ollie.
Thanks, Kathy. Sorry about that. I've been having internet problems at the restaurant the last couple of days. The heat is doing something to connectivity.
Okay. Well, we were having some problems here, but go ahead and get started whenever you want. And Juliet, I promoted you again to panelists, but I don't see.
I see her square. Yeah.
Okay, there you are. Okay, if anyone else would like to be promoted to panelists so they can see themselves on the screen, raise your hand. Otherwise, you can remain as you are.
Okay, well. Apologize everyone for the delay and the late start. We'll try to make up with the delay with some speed. Not really on the devices I thought I'd be using right now, so I apologize for that. We will work on. There's some feedback going on, Kathy.
I'm taking care of it. Thank you. Yes.
Right. It's probably one of the biggest agendas that we've had. especially this year, and it's maybe for this council. So anyhow, we got a pretty beefy consent agenda. Anybody would like to pull anything out of that? Any of the council members here?
I don't want to pull anything out, but I do want to call attention to CA8. It's for professional service agreements, and it is for $2 million plus $2 million plus $1 million, so well over $5 million. Oh, and another $1 million, $6 million for professional service agreements, including wage trim. So I believe these are engineering and design.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Mujgan. I got disconnected. I'm basically trying to say that if you guys cut meetings out and have no time available to the public, we won't be able to reach you. We need to reach you. 2,000-3,000 people showed up at your door a couple of weeks ago. They told you pass the resolution that says stop military aid to Israel.
We are going to have public comment at the end here. So we will get to the public, and we'll be sure to have it hopefully at least 30 minutes for enough time to make sure everyone can speak to us. That is definitely something that I come to these caucuses to do, is to be open and available to the public. So this is for the public more than it is for me, why I come here. So we will get to that. So Kathy, you were saying on CA8, are you done talking on that?
It's just a significant amount of money that is going to consulting firms as opposed to in-house. And I know that decisions have been made about the benefit of hiring contractors, but when we're at the point of $6 million just on CA8, I think we might want to reconsider what we can do in-house.
Yeah, these are big numbers. We do have a big budget as well. So as it relates to the proportionality of our budget, I can understand why we're working with larger numbers. I'll just leave it at that so we can save some time for some other issues.
Sure.
Thank you. Councilmember Dish or anyone else? There are a couple things I want to point out. One is, if I can, I had my notes and they're not with me right now. Our first electric truck, and I forget which one that is, on here, but the city is going to be purchasing, putting an order in for their first electric refuse truck. So that's something that's really exciting. I know that we've talked about things like that for several years, and now we're finally seeing it. Hopefully there's going to be some grant money that comes in to offset the additional costs for that, because they do cost about $250,000 more than a conventional dump garbage truck. But it's good to see the sustainability office doing what they do and leveraging money and getting grants to help offset the extra costs. Another thing was the affordable housing. We have two resolutions here. I think there's two. There's one in particular, CA29. I believe there's two on this list, using our affordable housing millage to put towards, actual affordable housing units that are affordable housing and not just supply side of luxury homes or luxury apartments. But for those folks who are in the 30 and 60% bracket of income, and these will also have supportive services associated with them as our millage allows for that. So it's really good, again, seeing what the working on for many years, becoming actionable. And so those are two significant developments that I think are positive and I think deserve some attention. We'll skip, I guess we'll skip the public hearing sections and we'll talk about those at a later point. We have a couple second readings. The first one is an ordinance to amend section 5.15 and section 5.16.6 of chapter 55, the code of the city of Ann Arbor, accessory dwelling units. And this obviously uncaps a lot of was put in place in 2016 that govern these structures. I'll let perhaps Councilmember Dish explain a little bit more since you help us with Planning Commission as to what those are and maybe we can elaborate on that.
Do you want to do that now or when we come to it on the agenda? Oh, no, we have come to it.
Yeah, we're already there.
Sorry. Okay, we're already there. Yeah, I think we've spoken about this before when before first reading, so I'll be very quick and then people can raise questions and concerns, of course. So, yes, as Councilmember Ramlawi mentioned, in 2016, Ann Arbor made the first step by legalizing accessory dwelling units, which weren't legal yet. But there were limitations. So accessory dwelling units can only be accessory to a single family home. That was true then, it's true now. That's just what they are. They are a second dwelling space on a lot that is zoned for a single family home. And in the December 2016 ordinance that first legalized them, you could only host an accessory dwelling unit if you had a minimum lot size of 5,000 square feet. And if you wanted to have, you could have an accessory dwelling unit in your garage or any other attached structure if you met the other requirements, but you could only have a detached accessory dwelling unit if you already had a detached accessory building on your property by the time that first ordinance took effect, which was December 31st, 2016, I'm pretty sure. And in that first ordinance, it was necessary that one of the properties, either the accessory unit or the primary residence, be owner-occupied. And in order to enforce that, there has to be a covenant attached to the property so that if it, you know, in future sales going forward, people understand that requirement is there. And so the changes that are proposed here make some significant regulatory changes to lift regulatory obstacles to the creation of accessory dwelling units. And so the minimum lot size is repealed. Accessory dwelling units can be attached to or detached from, I don't know, I'm not being totally articulate there, but in any residential zone other than RV parks. So it's not just in the single family housing, but any residential zone where there is a single family plot or package, you can now have an ADU. That is not to say that you can now put ADUs on multifamily homes. It's just to say that where there is a single family home in a zone that is zoned multifamily, they can have an ADU too. And the owner occupied requirement is removed. There's some minor other things that are removed, but they're minor because they were moot because everyone satisfied them anyway. So I'm not going to bother bringing those up. So numerically, 16,000 properties that already were legal to have ADUs on them have greater flexibility. They could have a detached ADU. they could put an ADU, they could be renting the principal residence and put an ADU on it, or they could, they could be renting out the principal residence and then also put an ADU on it if they wanted to. And I said the lot size requirement was gone, right? So 15,000 roughly have more flexibility in the ways that I just said. An additional 6,000 by virtue of the elimination of that minimum lot size are eligible. So there's a larger number of properties that will now be eligible to host an ADU, and people are able to create detached ADUs, or even to make attached ADUs. Like maybe you could put a garage as an addition to your house and put an ADU into that. That would not previously have been able to do that if they didn't have the structure. So I want to say there are kind of two ways of looking at it. One is that this is a huge change because there's so much more flexibility in the regulations. And I think that that is not wrong. Another is to say that going from it's illegal to it's legal was the bigger change. And this is not we're not doubling the number of ADUs. It's about an increase of a third. But because we are getting rid of that limitation on the need to have already in a detached dwelling in your yard, it means that there are many more properties really that are eligible. And so to be honest, I don't think we would be doing this if we didn't regard these as lifting significant regulatory barriers. Since 2016, about 24 people have applied for permits to build ADUs. We do not know how many have been constructed, but it's definitely fewer than that. So it's been, it's not something that a lot of people can afford to do because the construction is very, very expensive and even more so now. But even when it was, even pre-COVID, it was expensive to do this. And so based on the evidence from other places like Seattle and Portland, which have had these laws in place longer and have had a more favorable regulatory climate for a longer period of time, I don't think that this is going to be a huge in practice change. So you can look at it that, well, it opens up the door to one, so we should be worried, or you can look at it and say, well, yeah, based on the experience of the country, it's not that huge of a change. The idea is really to diversify the kind of housing we're offering. So there are people who could not afford to buy a house in Ann Arbor, but they might want to live in a house. And so being able to rent a small house that is attached to someone else's principal residence could be a very attractive thing, more attractive than an apartment along a transit corridor, which we hope will be cheaper than downtown, right? So thinking of the different ways we address affordability. So I've already went on longer than I meant to, so that's enough for now.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for giving us some of the information that you provided us. I know Council Member Griswold, you have your hand raised.
Yes, I have a question. Other communities such as Seattle and Portland, do they have the requirement that the owner must occupy either the home or the ADU? Okay, and do you have any numbers on what percentage of the ADUs are owner occupied, at least on the property, versus developer? The developer buys the property, builds an ADU, and then rents out the house as well as the ADU.
Yeah, as far as I know, nothing that I've read has broken things down like that. So we don't have that, those kind of figures available. The research that I've done on it has been to talk to people who are in real estate and stuff, and they have said that they think that ADUs are a pretty poor investment because, first of all, they're very difficult to finance, and because banks do not know how to treat them and they have very few comparables for them. And also banks will not give you if you already have a mortgage with the principal residence with a different bank, another bank is not going to give you a mortgage to build an ADU. So you'd have to be able to go back to your first lien holder and get that loan.
Okay.
There are lots of complexities in this. And so a developer who is trying to make money in the real estate market would do better to just buy a number of modest homes, not build ADUs on them, because they would likely be having to pay cash.
Okay. I'm hearing what you're saying. So then why are we including that ability at this time, given that we really don't have all the information? My son lives in Austin. The realtor told him that property values went up 43% in the area that he lives in. I feel that we need to balance gentrification and the rising cost of housing with any action that we take. And I'm just very, very concerned about the ability for a developer to move in, buy a house that right now is an affordable house for a family in Ann Arbor, and turn it into two rental units. But I'll ask some questions of staff before tomorrow morning.
Well, thanks. I'll try to keep it brief. I mean, there's so much to talk about on this, and I know others here tonight want to talk about it. There are other policy issues at play here. Most significant, I think, is home ownership and what home ownership means for people of color, minorities, people that are just starting off. That's where and that's how generational wealth is created in America and beyond. The perpetualness of renting constantly makes it much harder for folks to get ahead in the system that we live in. And you're just stuck living paycheck to paycheck, month to month, when you can't crack that ceiling. Home ownership is huge. And home ownership amongst Black people in this country is down greatly. Home ownership for individuals since the last Great Recession is down. Ownership is now being controlled more and more by corporations, more and more by big time investors who seek to have a safe harbor for money. So I just really struggle with what this may have, the consequences this may have on home ownership. When you look at the areas of town in Ann Arbor which are still affordable, that will look more attractive to investors who can buy smaller homes on big lot and construct another dwelling to maximize the potential that exists. And it's not against density or the ability to do infill, because I think that those type of developments are necessary. But when we don't have the owner-occupied requirement, we don't protect ourselves from that threat. And I know that others have said, when I brought it up in the past, that Chelsea, Dexter, our neighboring communities who now have also joined the fight for more affordable housing have put it in their ordinances to require owner-occupiedness. Now, that was met with a sharp rebuke by a progressive Democrat here on City Council who said, we don't compare ourselves to those communities. And, I fight back and I say, we need to work on this as a regional problem and a regional approach. We need to be looking at what our neighbors are doing around us to address housing and the housing crisis. So I do look to our neighboring communities to see what they're doing and really help form what we're doing here to maximize our potential. But I just want to ask real quick, what's the concern of requiring the owner-occupied requirement to this ordinance? Why is there not enough support for that? And I'm going to try to bring that amendment back tomorrow if it's if it's even parliamentary available to me. I have talked to the city attorney's office to bring that amendment back, probably to maybe get another vote on it. But what's the concern of folks not supporting that owner-occupied requirement?
There are a number of them, and they are laid out in detail in the AARP's report on accessory dwelling units. And their model ordinance for accessory dwellings was updated a few years ago and took out the owner-occupied requirement. First of all, anytime you attach a covenant to a property, which is what we have to do in order to make in order to have the owner-occupied requirement, you make it more difficult to sell. Second, many people get into, they buy a home. We'll posit that it has the ADU on the property. They're renting out the ADU. That's just fine. But what if they lose their job? What if they get transferred? What if they're older and their spouse dies? Or what if both parents die and the kids have this house? If the owner-occupied requirement is in place, that house cannot be rented. If there's an ADU on the property that's being rented, the house cannot be rented. There are all kinds of life changes that happen to people where they end up renting their principal residence. And none of these would be possible or viable. Or one of the larger uses for an ADU is sometimes an older person who can no longer manage the big house moves into the ADU and rents out the bigger house to either just people who are living there or maybe people who are caretaking for them. The older person has a fall, ends up having to move into assisted living. They have to evict the people that are in. The people who are currently renting the primary residence would have to leave because it is not legal for them to be there if the ADU isn't owner occupied. So this is a restriction with what people can do with their property. It's a restriction on what people can do with their property, which always lowers the property value in the market's eyes. And it imposes constraints on people in the face of life changes, some pleasant, some unpleasant, over which they have no control because they have less flexibility. So those are the reasons why it's spelled out in the AARP ordinance.
Well, thanks for giving me your reasonings behind it. I still, as much as I can understand and empathize with what's being said there with those issues and concerns, it's like a balancing act of what threat for me is larger. And I feel that the threat to the home ownership in the areas of town with large, parcels will become less affordable, but we'll just take it up again tomorrow and listen to more of what the community has to say later tonight, get on to the next one, which is B2, if that's okay with everybody. An ordinance to amend Chapter 55, rezoning of 9.8 acres of township to RC one single family and R1A single family to R4E with conditions multiple family dwelling. This is really a lot to say when many folks in the community already know about this, and this is the Valhalla project in the Fourth Ward next to the University of Michigan golf course. This is the second reading, and as was stated, this does come with conditions in the development agreement, and that is mostly pertaining to its all electric feature. But this is something that has caused a stir. There's, getting many emails from folks regarding this one. The folks in our community who like to see us build as much wherever as much without considering what's in the master plan, definitely support this project. Others who are concerned that this is spot zoning and has other issues to it are not so supportive of this project, even with its green feature of all electric. I will perhaps pause for a minute, and I'm not sure if Councilmember Dish is willing to expand on it, since you're on the Planning Commission and you have a little bit more information. Perhaps you can provide our audience or weigh in on this project. I'm sorry, you're muted.
Sorry, I was looking for my notes so that I can be very specific. And so let me give one more glance and see if I can find what I wanted to find. That's like completely crazy.
I can expand on it while looking.
I'll just go from what I remember the top of my head. I would want to reassure people that there's a difference between a spot zoning and a rezoning that is negotiated with a developer. And so these properties were formerly township, and when they were annexed to the city, the recommendation for their use was based on what they were next to. It was not based on a master plan. It was just what our habit is when we annex something, we just assign it the density that's appropriate based on the adjacent properties. And so in this case, this was envisioned as an 80 something unit subdivision. And so we were approached by Valhalla that wanted a denser zoning, but they agreed actually to more than the all electric condition, which is a pretty amazing thing for them to pull off, that it will be all electric heating and cooling and water heating and appliances and all of that. Much of the electricity generated on site by solar, or much or all, actually, I'm not entirely sure on that detail. Given the zoning designation we are giving them, or they've asked for and has been proposed that they get, they could have more units than what they are developing, but they agreed to a cap. So they are not developing as many units as in fact they could based on the zoning zoning designation that they asked for to get more than the 80 units. And this development, as we know, it's located next to the U of M golf course. And it is in a great place if you want people to be able to walk to services and bus or walk to their jobs. If they work downtown or Briarwood, that's an ideal location for that. So in terms of doing development that fits the 20-minute neighborhood, this is a development that does. Much of the development that we've seen in Ward 1 that happens pretty much out in the north parts of Ward 1 and also, in the north parts of Ward 1, those are not anywhere close to 20-minute neighborhoods. There are no services in this part of town that are accessible within 20 minutes, and there's poor bus service here. So if you compare the kind of development that's happening in the last remaining parcels that the city tends to have, they tend to be out farther. This is kind of amazing to have this centrally located parcel and to have this density asked for. So those are, but I just want to be clear that the master plan is clear neither one way nor the other way. And in fact, we have master plan documents that ask for 20-minute neighborhoods, that want the A20 plan, that wants solar-based heating and cooling. And so there are many ways in which this parcel or this proposal is very consistent with our master planning. And the question of what the density of this site should be is really open to discussion along with in light of our other priorities, because the choice of zoning designation was not a deliberate, thought over, chosen decision. It was made to be the most consistent possible with surrounding areas. And those kind of things get rezoned frequently, typically, when a developer comes up with an actual plan for it.
Well, thank you. You know, those are, you know, we definitely have a lot of goals here, but it just seems like there are some that are superseding and overriding all others. And we're seeing it a lot on this agenda where we are altering the master plan in a very hodgepodge way. This is just, I believe, not the responsible and appropriate way to plan for the future, to plan, you know, for a community that, you know, when others come to it, will say this was really well thought out. You know, it's gonna, in my opinion, I feel this project is on steroids, frankly. That I have concerns about if it's going to be able to be constructed and pulled off properly, or are we going to be looking at something that is a failed development, quite frankly. I think we're in a rush here to get to A20, and we're not really being methodical and considerate and thoughtful enough so that in the end, we don't destroy what made our community special to begin with. I really, to be honest, am not completely confident that DTE is going to be able to supply enough electricity to that development and everything else in the area in a reliable fashion. And I know that they've said they would, but DTE says a lot and you know, I don't think they're going to put it in writing. And so, you know, you have traffic concerns. The entrance and exit is very problematic here. And, you know, initially, planning staff recommended denial. That was changed after some changes were made to the electrification of the development. And I'm not so sure that I'm comfortable again with this development because of the lack of infrastructure, both for traffic and electricity being delivered to that area, on top of the fact that it's on steroids and doesn't fit with what we have the master plan. And really, we should be guided by the master plan. And if we want to get to these goals, we should have been working on our master plan this last year, and we haven't been. So I'll leave it at that for now. Councilmember Griswold, did you have your hand up?
I just had a question. I had read that only 10% of DTE's energy is considered clean at this point. And so I'm wondering if there have been any projections of what percentage of DTE's energy, electricity, is going to be clean, say 4 or 5 years out, because it concerns me if we have coal burning power plants creating electricity that are harming low income people in the downriver area so that we can have a electrical powered unit here that isn't clean energy. So the question is, again, what percentage of energy is expected to be clean energy coming from DTE 4 or 5 years out?
I mean, that's a really good question. If we were talking about driving an EV or something like that, but with this development, if it is producing most of its electricity through solar power, through solar energy, that question is less relevant. It's not as if we're switching from a fuel-based house to an electric-based house and expecting DTE to provide all of that with its dirty energy. Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. At what point can we imagine them making much greater strides towards cleaner energy. And I think we are already seeing them making strides, but I don't think anybody can give us that number. However, we don't, while we might, some of us might want to hang back a couple years before we invest in electrifying our homes and purchasing electric cars, hopefully, which will have a greater range and a lower price tag soon. We don't want to wait until we can, there's a circularity, chicken and egg problem, but we don't all want to wait till 2028 and say, okay, now I'm going to do it because the energy's cleaner. We've got to do it. And we've got to hope that some of the Biden plan and other things will help give incentives for DTE to have cleaner energy, but we don't want to put off. We really can't afford to put off. So, but that's really a different discussion than our discussion about this development, because it is going to be producing most of its energy by solar panels. And I will make sure that I know tomorrow night how much of it is. I think it's a lot of it, if not 100%. And sorry for not remembering. It's just too many details today and too busy of a weekend.
Oh, that's fine. And you're not the staff member. And I want to say, yes, we shouldn't put off. I drive an electric car. I've had for 3 years. I've had electric appliances since I built my house in 83, other than the furnace, which is a high efficiency, because that wasn't an option. So I'm committed. I just want to make sure that as much as possible, I am not harming others with an aggressive program. So thanks.
I might go renegade here and with the acquiescence of my colleagues. Is it possible for us to open this up to the public for these last two items, the ADU and Valhalla, since there are public hearings on these, rather than have them wait until the end?
That's fine.
All right, so we'll work with this and then work back and then work forward again, because it might as well be discussed while we're on the topic, if we could. This would be on Valhalla from
the host will
members
be informed
of the
that you would like to speak.
Please, if you'd like to, you'll have 3 minutes. Kathy, if you can so kindly keep us on.
Wait, but. No, I don't think that everybody can have 3 minutes on each of those.
My mic has just been unmuted. Am I now allowed to talk about the Palestine resolution?
No, we're still on an agenda item. Thanks.
So we just want to clarify.
Let's go 90 seconds, Lisa. Do you think 90
sure.
seconds?
And then people can ask their questions on both.
Yeah, and then they'll have some time at the end. So let's say 90 seconds on these, each one, if we could. Since we're on it, I appreciate the acquiescence. Since Sam is ready to go, Sam, you're first.
Yeah, sorry. Valhalla is very interesting, and I'm sorry I'm not speaking off topic, but I want to thank you for allowing public comment. And it's been my experience that public comment's been like that comment on each issue has been allowed at previous council caucus. And it seems if you don't have comment on each council caucus, it just doesn't work for very well. So I think it makes sense to have a more time limited on specific agenda items during council caucus. Otherwise, it's not terribly helpful. So thank you for opening up the final items. And if you call on me too, I wanted to discuss, I had a comment on ADUs, but I'm not, I have no other comments. So thank
you very
much for indulging
me. We'll go back to that in a minute. Yeah.
Thank you for indulging me.
Juliet?
Yes, I can do this in 90 seconds. I think that the way that this Valhalla project has gone forward, and I'm 100% in agreement with you, Ali, it is illustrative of an appetite for just getting things done and damn the consequences. And if there is opposition, we'll just roll right over people, because we've got goals that are so important that we will bend every rule we can find. That way we'll feel like we've really advanced the state of humanity. Here's the problem. There is no such thing as conditional zoning. That was explained to me by legal people who know more than I do about it. So what this means is, if this Valhalla project fails, which nobody ever talks about, when we're talking about changing zoning to accommodate gigantic builds. There's no way that you are going to be able to limit that number of apartments or whatever they're going to be to someone who's willing to step into Valhalla's shoes and build the way they were planning to build. Their agreement is a current agreement. It's not something that runs with the land. If you change the zoning, you have permanently changed that zoning to accommodate whatever huge number of builds the next developer wants to make. And I also want to just suggest to you, Lisa, you mentioned the rising, you mentioned the cost today, rising cost of lumber. I'm assuming that Valhalla has a lot of bucks. Let's say they actually do have the money to make this build work. What about the people who have to pay for them? So, you know, it's really short-sighted in so many ways, as are so many decisions made by city council these days. I'm done. Thank you.
Okay. Ali, we have two callers with their hands up. May I call on them?
Yeah, you can go ahead. Thanks, Kathy.
Okay. Phone number 464. Would you like to ask a question?
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is Linda Brower. Well, first, I just want to say that thank you for this discussion. I am so gratified to hear a really rational, informative discussion about both ADUs and Valhalla. I have not heard this on council, although it's been discussed. And I just thank you for that. I wish council discussions could be like this. I actually learned something that I didn't know about ADUs from Councilmember Dish about the problems if an owner has to go into assisted living or something. I mean, that was an angle I hadn't thought about. And I just wish City Council could replicate the kind of discussion we're hearing so far here tonight. So thank you for that. I'm still concerned about aspects of the ADU because I really don't want Ann Arbor to be turned into just a corporate housing owned by very wealthy out-of-state developers and everybody renting except for the very privileged people who live in certain areas of Burns Park and Ward 2. That is still a concern. Then with regard to Valhalla, I would like to ask why City Planning Commission, for the first time in memory, overturned what the staff suggested. I mean, the staff suggested about 85 units, which would be downsized. It would be smaller lots, single-family homes on smaller lots so that you could fit more in. That's a reasonable density for that many acres, very reasonable. It's quite dense, 85 small homes. They would hopefully be more affordable because they're smaller on smaller lots. As Councilmember Ramlawi said just earlier, we have an issue with people being able to afford starter homes in Ann Arbor. We need to supply more of those so people can buy into Ann Arbor and develop equity in their homes and pass it on to their children. This is becoming more and more impossible, and I'm worried that so many decisions that are taken right now are leading us down the path to corporate housing in such a rush. I'm very concerned that some council members who, you know, I understand they think it's progressive that housing density is going to solve all our problems, but it has unintended consequences, and the test of leadership is whether you're willing to look and examine those unintended potential consequences before you make decisions. And a very good way to approach this would be to finally get going on the master plan so we can have a community discussion and make some decisions about where we're going in the next 10 years and put it in our master plan and then let that master plan guide zoning decisions. We haven't done that yet. Approving Valhalla at this density is premature and dangerous. So please rethink that, those of you who are considering voting for it. Thank you for the opportunity to speak in the middle of the meeting. I appreciate Councilmember Ramlawi's suggestion that be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda.
The host would like you to unmute your microphone. You can press *6 to...
You are unmuted.
You're muted, Kathy.
Oh. Am I up?
Caller 677, you're up.
All right. This is Michelle Hughes, and I think that this Valhalla development is going to be real good. I like the idea of there being more housing. I think that having more housing available right on that bus line, right on Main Street, is going to be good for us. Having people who can, even if all these people drive, it's going to be better to have them drive from the Valhalla development than it would be to have them drive in from the surrounding townships and Brighton and all those other towns, because they won't all be trying to use the same freeways all at the same time. They'll be, you know, driving around inside of the town, and that'll be easier for us to handle. I just think that this is the Valhalla development is going to be a good thing. That's all I got. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are muted.
I guess we can work backwards and then work forwards. If anyone wanted to discuss the ADUs, if using this opportunity to speak on that change to our ordinance. Sam?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, my main recollection of the first ADU ordinance was that you needed a separate water line. So like less than five got built. So I'm glad to hear it's a little more well thought out. I understand the concerns about it, but it still seems not a lot will get built. So I appreciate all the concerns about what it might do to develop too much of single family currently zoned homes. But personally, I think it's a little overblown. So I like the flexibility. It seems it's a little better thought out now. I don't know that for sure, but it seems like it's a little better thought out. So we'll see what happens, but we'll see who's right. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Caller ending in 677. Is that Michelle?
You are unmuted.
Yep, it's Michelle. ADUs, this sounds great. I think it won't do enough to cause there to be more housing in town. It would be great if people could buy starter homes. It would be great if people could not have to rent, but like, it's not building housing isn't going to be. I don't see how we're going to make housing cheaper by not allowing any to be built. This might not have a big enough effect, but it's. I think doing something is better than doing nothing. That's all.
You are muted.
Thank you, Michelle. All right, we'll move on since there's still plenty more to discuss. Next big item on the agenda, resolution to adopt that Ann Arbor moving together towards Vision Zero, the City of Ann Arbor Comprehensive Transportation Plan, essentially updating our master plan when it comes to the transportation system. That's being done. So I'm not sure if my colleagues here who have a strong interest in Vision Zero have anything to say about this. I know we don't have our other liaison or member who sometimes attends, but I'll leave this to people that really work on this issue more than I do. Councilmember Griswold, anything to say? All right. I guess we'll learn more tomorrow. And if anyone has any questions, please send them to us. But again, this is updating all the other little plans that we've made and the tweaks we've made to them to give us more coherent fashion to approach our transportation system going forward. Again, this is something I would like to do with our land use plans, but that would be a lot harder to get to consensus, perhaps. The next item, we have some first readings. One big one, this was postponed to this meeting. It's an ordinance to amend section 8.530 of chapter 105, housing entry to the show premise and time for rental agreements of title 8 of the building regulations. of the City Code of Ann Arbor. This is being brought forward by Councilmember Nelson and Councilmember Radina, who both will be with us tomorrow to explain this. We've heard a lot from the community on this. Many folks who manage properties and own properties have spoke out with concern regarding extending the time from 70 days, which I think all of us can agree is rather premature. But to extend it to 240 days sounds that might be too far of a move all at once, and where that lands in the calendar and where the students are, and et cetera. I know there are some other issues that Councilmember Nelson has been passionate about regarding this. I will just say for myself, I find something in closer to 150 days, 140 days more reasonable when it comes to the calendar for all interested parties. I don't know if any of my colleagues here want to speak on this. Okay, we're going to continue to move, and then at the end we can discuss if the audience would like to talk about that. We'll go to the next one, an ordinance to amend Chapter 112, Non-Discrimination, Section 1, or I'm sorry, 9.151, Title 9 of the Code of City of Ann Arbor, to add definition of race to include prohibition against race-based hair discrimination. This is work that's being done through our Human Rights Commission. The Crown Language Resolution is attached. I believe this will have unanimous support from Council tomorrow. Not sure if anybody here wants to add to that discussion right now. All right, another big land use issue coming to us, an ordinance to add section 5.12.9 and to amend sections 5.15, 5.163, 5.174, 5.204 of chapter 55, the Unified Development Code, Title 5 of the Code of the City of Ann Arbor, a new zoning district, TC1 transit corridor. This is a big one. This, when we talked earlier about unintended consequences, may have many. I believe that it will be most likely approved. But I not sure we're all aware of what it means when it goes into play. I will ask my colleagues here if they have anything to add to the discussion at this point. Councilmember Dish.
Sure, and this time I'll be very quick. So Council has seen transit corridor zoning before and voted it down, in part, I think, because it came with an unlimited height cap, or there was no cap on the height. And so what the goal of transit corridor zoning is to have to locate housing with greater density on in parts of the city that are more peripheral than downtown. So we know that the market for an apartment for downtown is high. We know that the cost of an apartment in downtown is high. And so if by using reliable transit along corridors that are meant to support, meant to tolerate buses running frequently, we can build some fairly dense rental housing. We can provide we can use the private market, we can use private developers to give us housing that, while not affordable in the sense that the city developed housing is affordable, it is less expensive than the downtown housing, which is really, as we can see in the report that we saw in 2015, it's been prohibitively expensive for people who are not students, who are actually making their lives in their 20s and early 30s here in Ann Arbor, you know, having their first jobs or what have you. And so this ordinance is designed to encourage that. It is, unlike the way we sometimes think about zoning, it does not create a zone in a particular place. It is a template that a developer can request. And the template requires 15-foot first floor height, so a higher and it involves a significant amount of transparency on that first floor, active uses in the corner, so that essentially you're not walking past a big block of concrete. You're walking past a building that's kind of interesting to walk past in the ways that we find in our most interesting cities in the U.S. and in other places where, you know, people love to go and walk and shop. Some details that it's good for folks to know is that in this transit corridor zoning, your building has to be a minimum of two stories. So what we are trying to do is get away from the typical strip mall model of one story with lots of parking between the business and the street. We want two stories right on the corridor. If you are within 80 feet of a residential neighborhood, that is to say, roughly across the street, the maximum allowable height is 55 feet. So that would be roughly a 3-4 story building. If you are within between 80 to 300 feet from a residential neighborhood, that maximum height goes up to 75 feet. If you are between 300 and 1,000 feet from a residential neighborhood, your height can go up to 120 feet. Again, roughly a 10, 11 story building. If you are more than 1,000 feet from a residential district, that is multifamily or single family, you can go as high as 300 feet. So this time there's a very clear set of caps that are meant to be responsive to the context of the neighborhood. And the ordinance also eliminates mandatory parking minimums. That's not to say that you don't have to provide parking, and your financial institution will assuredly make you provide some parking. But we are no longer going to say, we're no longer going to place a minimum parking requirement for these buildings, precisely because we are assuming that they're located on transit corridors where all kinds of services, not just your employment, but other services are accessible by public transit. And so parking spaces, which are expensive for developers to build and greatly add to the cost of units, are taken out of the picture here. Those are some of the highlights. It's important for people to know that this zone was pieced together out of existing zoning designations in the city. So it wasn't made up out of thin air. There are features that we took from the office zone and from the mixed use zone that already exists. So that's that.
Thank you, council member, for explaining that a little bit. And again, with acquiescence from my colleagues, opening this back up to for the public, because there does seem to be interest in, to speak on this. I am concerned because of the unintended consequences, and I appreciate the reasons that were given in allowing more permissive development. But it's hard for me to hear to imagine this whole city, the 40 square miles or 37 square miles of it, where all these possibilities lie and exist. And I know there are just certain corridors, but I just, you know, it comes to me real quick when it comes to like D1, D2 zoning. No one saw 413 East Huron, you know, as a possible development. And, you know, 413 East Huron created a lot of discomfort and still, frankly, does for a lot of people. And I, you know, we'll just throw caution to the wind. I don't know exactly, you know, 300 feet from what, you know, 1,000 feet might sound like a lot, but 1,000 feet isn't really that far, and 300 feet is pretty darn tall.
No, 1,000 feet is a lot. There aren't very many places in the city where you are 1,000 feet from a residential zone. Staten Eisenhower is one of them, and it may be the only one, because we are such a heavily residential city. So that one's a lot, but 300 feet is not as much, clearly. We can all do that math.
You know, when and I understand the how poor of a land use it is when it comes to parking, but when you get rid of parking, you're just transferring that parking and that demand somewhere else. And I see it on the Old West Side here, you know, 616 North Main and the one across the street. You know, people are parking in the neighborhoods. They just go and park in other places, and it just gets pushed over onto somebody else, you know, and the developers, you know, they get theirs, they're gone, and then it becomes the residents' problem and, you know, your council member who gets all the emails complaining about the parking issues in residential areas because of people still, you know, using their cars. But I know that we got a lot of people who want to talk about this. Councilmember Griswold, before we go to the general public, go ahead.
I have a question. Would a transit zoning allow for a hotel to be built? I've seen the plans for Arborland, and that includes a hotel as well as some residential use. And the concern from the neighbors in Wood Creek is that they're going to be looking out their backyards at a very tall building. And so I really don't have the information to tell them exactly what can and cannot happen. But it seems like a transit corridor is we're arguing that we need it for more density and more residential, but now we're also sliding in hotels into zoning that otherwise might not allow hotels. And so I'm just wondering if that's accurate based on what I'm being told.
Yep, hotels would be allowed, but how tall the hotel would be would depend on how close it was. And Briarwood has not been envisioned as part of the transit corridor zoning.
Okay, Arborland though?
Oh, Arborland, I'm sorry. You said Arborland and not Briarwood. Right. Arborland is pretty close to residential, though, so it would be limited by in the way that I said. So, you know, I'd have to go look at that. But we should ask staff, actually, because they would know exactly how close Arborland is to a residential. And they could tell you if we're looking at a 75-foot cap there or 120-foot cap there.
Oh, OK, great. Yeah, I'm just getting questions from constituents and the transit corridor rules seem to be changing. So, okay, I will ask staff. Thanks.
We'll call on someone who hasn't spoke yet. I think number ending in 867. It could be wrong, though.
Okay, and I'll do 90 seconds on the timer.
Caller ending in 867, you can go ahead.
The host will be informed that you would like to speak.
On my screen, it looks like they're muted.
Yeah, they are muted still. There you go.
All right. Ollie, I wasn't listening, but I don't believe you're on to the Palestine resolution yet.
No.
Okay, you can mute me and I'll talk to you later.
Councilmember Mlai, could you ask that caller to deal with their feedback problem before they speak to us?
Sure, Kathy, if you can remind me. Thanks.
Yep.
I'll let you pick out the numbers, Kathy.
Oh, okay. Caller ending with 464.
Caller 464, you can go ahead.
Hello?
Oh, I'm sorry. I like the idea of transit-oriented development, but I just want to make sure that, I don't know the details, but I want to make sure that the neighborhoods are not, you know, overshadowed by these huge buildings, and it looks like that's being worked into the resolution, so I guess I'm for the most part okay with it, but I think it's got to be used very, very carefully. And I like the idea of getting rid of the strip malls and all that horrible parking, you know, in front of them, which doesn't make the sidewalks very pleasant to walk down. So this could be good, but I'm also worried about, like, design guidelines. I wonder if that could be worked in. Anyway, thanks for thinking about it.
Okay, thanks. I think the other callers want to speak on other subjects, so I suggest we go
Juliet,
and then have public comment at the end, given the time.
Okay, again, less than 90 seconds for sure. I'm agreeing with Ali about the short-sightedness of not providing for parking. Let us assume that everybody makes the switch to electric vehicles so that we're all happy with how they're preserving the green and meeting, you know, the Vision Zero that we've got, or whatever we're calling it. But, you know, let's assume that some people actually do move into Ann Arbor because they've been dying to do it right along, and it's only affordable housing or whatever that's prevented them. They're still going to want to go visit their relatives. They have to have a place to put their car. They're not necessarily going to all be, I don't know, 20, 25-year-olds who don't ever want to set foot out of the city. I'm just concerned about the fact that what Ali says is absolutely true. We've seen it again and again. If you don't make room for people's cars, then where do you put those cars when there's no room for them? They put them in front of other people's houses. They're going to be parking all over the place. It's just foolish. That's all I got.
Councilmember Dish, you were going
to... Yeah, just let me reiterate that I did not say that there would be no parking. I said that there would be no mandatory parking minimums. There is not a bank on the planet that would allow you to build a 5, 7, 10-story building without providing some parking. But currently, we, in many parts of the city, we require mandatory parking minimums, and developers of these kinds of properties typically satisfy them by putting some on site, and then they purchase space in adjacent parking lots, especially overnight. And that goes unused. So let's let the developer and the banks think about, based on who's going to live here, how much parking is needed. It's not saying don't have any parking. It's saying we're going to let you decide what the reasonable parking is for this building. And they have every interest in getting it right. Otherwise, they aren't going to get tenants. If it's really important to 30% of their tenants to have a place to put their car, then they're going to want a place to put their car. We are seeing increasingly developments providing space for a rideshare car that they contract permanently with their own building. That's another way that people get around this, because as many of you all know, the car is the second biggest expense for people, monthly expense for people after housing. And so for some people, what affordability looks like is not having to own their own car, but they rely on rideshare when they want to make a longer trip, or they even rent a vehicle when they want to make a longer trip. But it's less and less attractive. It's less attractive to some people to own a car. And so but that's not to say that we provide no parking. So I just want that to be clear. It's very different to say eliminating mandatory parking minimums and providing no parking, because that is not going to happen at this stage.
Well, thank you for your perspective. But I believe, you know, as those who are in charge of planning for the future, we have a responsibility and a role to play in that, and not just leave it for banks and developers. That's unfortunately, with all due respect, they're looking out for themselves. They're not looking out for the community. They're not looking at A20. They're not looking at safety of of the children, the welfare of the city, or anything like that. They're looking to make a deal and on to the next. And so I think we need to be very careful to be able to abdicate that responsibility and leave it to banks and developers to figure out. I just think that's going to be not to our benefit, to say the least. But we have to move on as they're being pressed with time. We haven't even got to staff's business or council's business yet. So tomorrow's going to be a long, long meeting. We got C4, an ordinance to amend a bunch of different sections and to repeal sections to the Unified Development Code of the City of Ann Arbor plan project site plan modifications. Here you have a whole lot of things changing again and to advance our other goals that we've put in place. I don't know if Councilmember Dish, you have a pretty heavy responsibility being on a planning commission. If you can enlighten us on this at all or not, but I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but it seems like I have.
No problem. I was prepared for this. So essentially what this is doing is a planned project is when it's not a rezoning. It's when a developer or anybody has a site that they want to build on, and there's some reason why they can't make their project fit with our usual setback requirements or our usual height requirements. And the way the city used to do this was to say, well, if you want to give us something that we want, like affordable units or sustainability, we'll give you something that you want. But none of it was spelled out, which is very bad because it means that different people got different deals and the city didn't necessarily have clear and firm guarantees. And so all this is doing is making it very clear, if you want X, you do Y. And so X can be, you want more height, you want more flexibility with setbacks. We had one of these under the old standards, but we evaluated it according to the new standards, not legally, but we looked at it to see what would have happened under the new standards. And this was just a case where it was a site that got narrower. It wasn't a perfect rectangle. It got narrower at one end. And so the developer, in order to maximize what they could put on there, the townhomes they could put on there, needed flexibility with setbacks. And so they offered electrification as something that they would give us, and there were a few other things. That was before these new requirements where it's just a straightforward thing. It's not going to go before Planning Commission. There's no negotiation. It's written down. You know what you have to do if you need this thing for us. So that's what that is. It's really making clear and uniform a process that has been fuzzy and project by project and managed at a negotiation level rather than simply written into code.
Thank you for helping us better understand these proposed changes. And yes, it's very unpredictable waters that people get into when they choose to do a plan as a PUD. I'll need to obviously plan.
It's not a PUD. Yeah, that's a completely different thing. Plan projects are different.
Okay.
Yeah, PUD is a zoning designation. Plan projects are modifications you can give someone, but they're not a zoning designation.
Okay. Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Again, this is not my bailiwick, unfortunately. I have not served on planning, and I don't sit through those meetings as you do. So appreciate this. And I really just at the mercy and the guidance of my constituents and my colleagues when it comes to certain matters as such. We'll move on and hopefully have some time at the end. So the next one is DC1, a resolution to appoint Christian Kristen to the Housing Board of Appeals, 7-vote requirement. I know Kristen through my dealings working with her, because she's at the health department, Washtenaw County Health Department, been there for a while, been real active with COVID and other things. So I hope I got the right person in mind when I'm describing them. Simple 7-vote requirement, because I believe they're a non-resident. The next thing is a resolution establishing a council subcommittee for the purpose of studying and setting parameters for a payment in lieu of taxes, a pilot program for the city of Ann Arbor. This is something that was brought forward by Councilmember Hayner, which he's been talking about for the whole time he's been on council, trying to find ways to tap into areas of our community that perhaps could help us with some of our goals and some of our needs. And we have a lot of nonprofits here in Ann Arbor, thankfully. They do offer a community benefit, but perhaps they could be doing more for the community and we just don't know about it. He had reached out to me and Councilmember Nelson prior to the last meeting, because it got added to the agenda late, so he needed 2 additional co-sponsors. I agreed to be a co-sponsor on this, but I'm not the author of it, and so I think in principle I can support it, but for questions I think in more detail it can be responded to by Councilmember Hayner, who unfortunately is not with us tonight. But I think it's a pretty straightforward thing. I know there were concerns at the last council meeting, because this was postponed, that this would consume too much of staff's time, and whether we should be asking staff to spend time on something that we thought, or some people think, doesn't have much of a chance of success. That's, I think we send staff on a ton of goose chases, and I try not to, but I think this is one that deserves some attention. Next, we have DC3 is a resolution to approve amendments to the council rules. This is being brought by the admin committee. We have been discussing ways to better facilitate our meetings. One way, the major way, I guess, here, it's not that major, would be to start our meetings 30 minutes sooner. We had proposed during our admin meeting to move them a full hour to the 6 o'clock hour. That did not get the support of the committee. We were able to get a split vote in favor of bringing forward the body this proposed change of having our meeting start at 6:30, so that we can hopefully end discussions by midnight. Gives us a little bit more time before it gets too late. And then you also have a rule change for the public speaking speakers and the public, I guess, Council Member Griswold, you had proposed this change, and you could you expand on this, the second rule change? I guess all speakers, I don't know why this is there. I think this new rule change is just as a response to COVID and our virtual nature of meetings. But it says all public speakers, up until now it has said in our rule book, all public speakers must speak from the podium. Well, we haven't been using a podium in quite a while. So they have added this language, unless the public speaker is attending remotely. The idea is that we will continue to allow the public to call in even when we go back in person, so that we can become more accessible using the tools and technology we have if it's legally permissible. So there is discussions going on actively on how we could allow the public to call into meetings without physically being there as they were in the past. So that's why this rule changes is being proposed.
And I know that the Attorney General discussed this at a recent meeting, and so she is looking into it. And hopefully the change would be made to the Open Meetings Act as opposed to us just passing a resolution.
Thanks, Kathy, on that update. The next resolution is support is titled Supporting for the People Act, House H.R. 1 and S. 1. You know, I guess we can all get behind this. I don't see anything nefarious. I just wish perhaps this was something that could have been in place years ago. My only question on this one is, and it's not a big one, is just perhaps this could have gone through the policy committee and been taken up through the policy committee as they do take up these type of legislative issues. But this is being brought forward by some council members outside of that. And so I guess they'll be there tomorrow to speak on it. And I don't know if my colleagues here have anything to say.
Only that Radina and I are on the Council Policy Agenda Committee. And so it may have been an issue of timing, and they may have checked with staff as well.
Thank you, Councilmember, for reminding me who's on who on what committee these days. The next resolution is one I'm bringing forward. It's a resolution recommending to recommend and prioritize the allocation of the state and local fiscal recovery funds. There will be $24 million given to the city of Ann Arbor over the next year. I think we've received half of that those funds by now, and we're supposed to receive the other half in a year from now. I believe it's important for us to be prudent, responsible, thoughtful, careful, strategic, all of the above, plus some more, as to how this money gets spent. And I believe that staff should give us direction on that. And I've asked the city administrator and staff to come back to council with this resolution by the end of September to recommend where they believe the funding for these funds should go, while keeping in mind the applications that we've applied for federal and state grants on major projects, also working with our county partners, finding out how we can partner up with the county on certain policies that overlap and leverage and magnify the potential that we have with the funds that come to us. So simply, this is asking for direction from staff as to, based on our plans and priorities and everything else that's within this resolution, it's pretty simple, one pager, come back to us and suggest how we ought to go about spending that money. Councilmember Griswold.
I'm fully in support of this resolution, and I think that, and I've talked to the city administrator about this, we really need to look at ways to spend this one-time money to reduce recurring future charges, such as investing in technology for streetlights that would reduce our maintenance. We also have technology that allows for solar-powered streetlights. People have heard me say it before, but I think it's criminal to continue to have crosswalks that do not meet minimum standards. We had a 10-year moratorium on streetlights, yet we still have crosswalks that are not illuminated, and we seem to be debating it rather than taking care of the problem. I'm not going to quote a bunch of statistics tonight, but this is an issue that is not even debated in the vast majority of communities. It's part of urbanization and density that you have illuminated crosswalks. Thank you.
I appreciate your support on this. I'm hopeful that I'll get support from the body tomorrow. I think it's wise with what you're saying that we want to find ways that in the long term we make investments in things that pay us back.
Mm-hmm.
And this money is not used for short-term cash flow issues, that we make sound investments that take off the overall burden that we face in the long run when it comes to being financially sustainable. We'll move on to the next one. DC6 is a resolution to request that Councilmember Hayner resign from the City of Ann Arbor Council. This was discussed at the admin committee meeting. It was an emergency meeting that was called by Councilmember Grand and Mayor Taylor to discuss actions and words used by Councilmember Hayner when talking with the press. We've also, in that same meeting, bifurcated the issue and will be taking up the matter using Rule 12, which is a lengthy prescribed process in our rule book when somebody files a sworn complaint against the council member. My opinion is that this resolution did not need to go through the admin committee. This was not the proper channel for this type of resolution, in my opinion. I believe the admin committee is there to deal with these issues and is going to be dealing with this issue through Rule 12. I feel that this resolution perhaps could come at the conclusion of the investigation that is initiated when somebody files a sworn complaint using Rule 12. I won't say too much on this. I'm not a sponsor of this resolution, and I think I should leave it to the sponsors to speak to the matter more so. Any of my colleagues want to speak to this? Okay, moving right along. This is DS1, simply a resolution authorizing summary publication of a prior ordinance if it was to be passed, which is the ADU ordinance, the second readings. If that one gets passed, this is just a formality to publish those technical changes. And so this is somewhat in a response to that earlier resolution that we need to do and to be in compliance. I think that is it. We can move to public comment. I don't see anything else unless I miss something.
Okay. Why don't I, given the time, I'll let people know when they have spoken for a minute, and we'll target 90 seconds in total.
Can you give us 2 minutes? I mean, we got 30, if we extend it to 8:10 because we did start 10 minutes late.
Okay, you're a softie, but I'll do it. All right.
Thanks.
Two minutes.
I hope we can hear from many. Again, it is the main reason I come to these is to hear from the public. I kind of know where the rest of us stand on these issues beforehand. But here we go. Caller ending in 867. You can go ahead and you have 2 minutes.
The host will be
please
informed that you would like to speak.
Any background noises?
This is Blaine Coleman. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
All right. You know, I find it almost impossible to believe that after something like 3,000 marchers were standing, marching right outside your city council building on May 22nd, yelling for you to approve the resolution against military aid to Israel and marching all through the town against military aid to Israel, I find it just almost unbelievable that not a single council member will propose that resolution. Now, you know, Kathy, you had said you would propose it and just nothing happened. Jeff Hayner said he would propose it, nothing happened. Ali, I think, feels that, you know, he hasn't told me anything, but I think he feels the consequences to him would be absolutely devastating if he even thought about introducing the resolution. So that's the three of you. Councilmember Dish has made a lot of sophisticated political studies about what happens when people are not represented politically all over the world. And what happens is really bad things. She knows that. And she is also studied really pro-Palestine politicians sympathetically, like Ralph Nader and Jesse Jackson. So maybe she could introduce the resolution against military aid to Israel. But somehow I don't think that'll happen. And I'm trying to understand the dread fear that you have of even introducing that basic human rights resolution, considering what Israel just did. They just killed hundreds of Palestinians.
2 minutes.
With your
Thank
money.
You.
Thank you, Blaine. Next caller, ending in 677.
You are unmuted.
Hi, this is Michelle.
You are 941.
I am
Michelle Ryan Hughes.
Blaine, can you mute yourself?
Hi, this is Michelle Hughes. I am begging you guys not to drag out DC-6, the resolution asking Hayner to resign. I am begging you to make it a swift and unanimous rebuke of his homophobic and bigoted and racist language. That would really help the community a lot to feel safe. It would help our LGBTQ community. It would help our Black community to feel like the city council has their back and is thinking about them rather than their political alliances. If we hear a lot about, the more we hear about, you know, imagined due process complaints, the less we hear about the safety of the LGBTQ community and the Black community. And when I say imagined due process complaints, this is what I'm talking about. That the resolution asking Hayner to resign is a non-binding resolution, and it's following the exact same process as when City Council supported a boycott of Wendy's, when City Council passed the anti-Asian hate resolution. It's the same process. There's no additional process that is due. What I've heard some council members suggest that there should be additional process, but these suggestions have all been arbitrary and just kind of like there's no process written down that they're drawing from. They're just like, I wish it had gone this way, I wish it had gone that way. But that's not what due process
30
means.
Seconds.
There's no process that is due, and Hayner is not being deprived of life, liberty, or property. The choice to resign is still his, but please make that suggestion that he resign rather than continuing to harm the LGBTQ community, the Black community, and whoever he decides to harm next. Thank you.
You are muted.
Thank you, Michelle. And then the caller ending in 867.
I believe that was Blaine.
Blaine?
Yeah, that was me, Ollie. I'm going to sign off now.
All right, thanks. And 941 is the number I see. Caller ending in 941.
Hello?
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 You can go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Mujgan Savabi Isfahani. I am calling to say that Ann Arbor as a city is an anti-racist city, but Ann Arbor City Council cannot be any more racist than it is now. it is to your shame that after so much global outrage at what Israel did to Palestinians, you sit silently and watch it. It is to every single one of you shame to sit and watch as children be blown up into pieces by Israeli bombers, which you paid for. You are a racist city council. You cannot redeem yourself unless you pass the resolution that says we are against military aid to Israel. People of Ann Arbor have spoken. They have come to your doorstep by the thousands. They have yelled at you and said, cut off military aid to Israel. People of the campus have passed resolutions. People of the campus have written on the rock, fuck Israel. And you pretend that nothing is happening. Every single one of you sits silently and watch this slaughter. It is on your neck. It is on your hands, the blood of every child that was murdered by Israel. You enable Israel to murder us. You are murderers. You are murderers, and you know it. You know what the right thing is to do, but you shy away from it with all kinds of excuses. Nobody believes that you're anti-racist until you say Israel is an apartheid state. Let us cut off military aid to it. Shame on all of you who haven't done it already. Shame on you. I speak for the thousands who have been killed with your dollars.
2 minutes.
Shame on every one of you.
Thank you. Is there anybody else who'd like to speak to us? Caller ending in 464. You can go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Linda Berauer again. I was looking at the e-comments, and I, pretending to see two race-based hair discrimination, I read a comment by Luna Oriole, and I think she's up for confirmation to be on some committee. I don't know who she is. But her comment was to ask that language be added to that, prohibiting discrimination based on choice of hairstyle or head covering due to religious beliefs. And when I read that, I thought, yes, that is a brilliant suggestion, and I'm hoping that somebody, one of you, will propose that as an amendment to add to C2, prohibiting discrimination based on choice of hairstyle or head covering due to religious beliefs. So that would include things like, you know, the Sikhs, turbans, and women who wear the hijab, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think we really need to do that, and I'm hoping we can get it done now at the same time. It's a great idea that Ms. Oriole suggested. Then I have thought a lot about the Jeff Hayner issue. I don't know Jeff personally, but what I've been watching him for years, I know he has a tendency to speak a little bit too honestly and forthrightly and not always very sensitively, but I know he's not a racist and I know he's not a homophobe, and I believe he's done more than almost any city council member in many, many years to support those two communities. So this is very ironic. And I have put a lot of thought into an email that I am going to send to all of you later this evening, and I'm really hoping that you'll take a look at it and think of what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that we do something restorative rather than purely punitive, because I hear what Michelle Hughes is saying. I know many people were offended. I don't think they looked at the context or the intent of his words. And I think that city council can take leadership and do some kind of restorative community conversation. I think Jeff needs counseling about not being so loose and thoughtless, which he was, and he's admitted. But I don't think being punitive is going to heal the community. I think we need a restorative discussion with
Two
the
minutes.
People who
Thank
were offended.
You.
Thank you, Linda. We have former council member Ann Bannister. You're next.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. Wow, this has been a huge meeting, starting from the $6 million for professional services all the way through the ADUs in Valhalla. Good points about if Valhalla fails, we permanently change the zoning, and so the next developer could buy rights, do whatever they want there. And then the transit corridor, Ollie, excellent comments about when you get rid of parking, the cars are just parking somewhere else, and that we have a responsibility to not leave it to the bankers and the developers to tell us how much parking we need, because we've seen it happen that time and time again, there's people parking all over in your driveway and in front of your house and externalizing the developer's cost. But I also wanted to talk about Councilmember Hayner and this request for him to resign. And I again agree completely with Councilmember Ramlawi that this resolution should come at the conclusion of the investigation.
30 seconds, please.
The conclusion of the investigation when someone files a complaint under Rule 12. I believe Sam Robinson, the MLive reporter, has more to say on this topic in Jeff's favor, and various members of the LGBTQ community have been speaking up for Councilmember Hayner. And I feel it's much more conduct unbecoming a council member when Councilmember Briggs sent the offending material unredacted to thousands of people long after Councilmember Hayner had deleted it. So please vote no on DC6. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, anyone else like to leave us with some thoughts?
Hello? Hello? This is Rita Mitchell speaking.
Yeah, hi. Rita, you can
It wasn't clear to me. It wasn't clear to me how to raise my hand, but I just want to say I appreciate the comments that were just presented by Linda Brower and Ann Bannister about Jeff Hayner, and I hope you'll consider a different kind of approach than super punitive. He is a creative member of council, and I would like to see him continue. I want to comment on a couple of the other issues that you're considering tomorrow on the Valhalla project. I would say that I like the idea of all electric building. I think it's a great idea, but we do need to look at what is the proportion of electricity that's coming from on site with the installed solar panels. What we don't know is that proportion. And I think I really appreciate Councilmember Griswold's comment about adding to the grid supply, draw on the current grid supply, which definitely is based on coal and gas and nuclear. Those are not the kinds of power that we want to use. And so we want to know that we're moving toward a clean energy future. And so it would be good to know the proportion. So 500,000 kilowatt hours sounds great, but let's understand what it represents. With respect to the transit-oriented development, my concern is a chicken and egg question, which has to do with transit. And I haven't really heard transit discussed in this whole process so far. It seems that it focuses on the buildings, but what about the buses? Is the AAATA prepared to support the kind of services that are being identified as needed? Are people going to use the buses? I hear a lot of people talk about transit-oriented development, and I really wonder how many of them use the bus. I would like people to use the bus. I have used the bus. It's good, but we need to make sure that it is used and prepared to support those areas that are going to need the service. And last, about the pilot discussion, I think you all can start this as a conversation, maybe not make it a huge part of staff action, but give them some parameters that you'd like to see them accomplish and give some direction for future consideration, whatever those may be. Like what other communities are doing, what's the result of it, what benefit will we get from it, what detriment could it be to those organizations or to the community. There's the big mix, obviously, but I think it's worthwhile investigating. And that's it for me for tonight. Thank you all. Good night.
Thank you, Rita. Kathy, you have your hand up?
Yes, I just wanted to repeat a comment that I made at the beginning of the meeting, and that is that I am evaluating whether we want to continue with caucus during the summer, whether we want to take a summer break, whether we want to look at other ways to accomplish our goals in a more effective manner. And so if anyone has opinions that they haven't voiced yet, please send me an email and I'll get something posted in the next week.
Thank you, Kathy. Sam?
Thank you. I just wanted to, thank Kathy again for doing so many of these and thank Ali for chairing. I was just a little confused. I really liked that you started opening each comment, each agenda item up for comment. Not to seem pessimistic or dour, but on the point of whether to have these, it seems if there's not discussion of each agenda item, I see them as being less worthwhile. So if people are able to discuss each agenda item and ask a question and then have a council member respond, it's helpful. But if there's not discussion on each agenda item, I'm not sure why it's worthwhile, but thank you all very much for attending and all the other participants. Thank you.
Thanks for the feedback, Sam.
We have two people with their hands up.
Okay, you can call on them, Kathy. Thanks. You're muted, though.
Caller with the phone number ending in 205, you may speak.
Thanks, Councilmember Griswold. This is Joe Spaulding. I want to talk really briefly about the three pillars of white supremacy publicly today and how it operates. It's not a bunch of Klansmen riding through the streets. They know that doesn't play anymore. We do know that we have a white supremacy problem across Michigan, and I urge anyone to look at the comments section of the story, any of the stories about the resolution to ask Jeff Hainer to voluntarily resign once they get posted. I promise you'll see a lot of overt white supremacy there. That's one of the pillars, is the overt white supremacy. The other is the edgelord Tucker Carlson, Jeff Hainer type, who dances all over the line publicly and has to retract and make apologies once in a while. But the third one is the one that I heard a bunch of tonight that really broke my heart as a person of color. And those are the apologists for the one that's dancing over the line. And what that end-all signal does is it tells the first group, the real right-wing supremacists, that they can get away with whatever they want as long as they get to use the right code words and as long as they stick where the lines are. Meanwhile, the person dancing over the line is defining that for them. And as a person of color, this really broke my heart. I have some pretty formative experiences being called racial slurs as a kid, and having the administration at schools just completely sweep it under the rug. He's really a good kid. He didn't mean that. His parents are really influential. And he's really just having a bad day. Why don't you just stop playing near him?
30 seconds, please.
And this is heartbreaking. It destroys people. And for city council to consider giving sanction and for people to argue to give sanction for the use of that specific very damaging word is abysmal, it's horrifying, and it's terrifying for people of color. It makes Ann Arbor seem like a sundown town. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Caller ending with the digits 556.
Hi, this is Ralph McKee. Can you hear okay?
Yes.
I had an item which I missed most of the council, or of the caucus tonight. But I wanted to just give a brief introduction to this. There's an item on the consent agenda about $25,000 for a search for a new city attorney, given what recently happened in the Gelman case, in which I don't have time to go into the detail here, but I think our city attorney and outside counsel essentially went against the city council's wishes in terms of the consent judgment for that we all try to lobby and help research and talk about rejecting. It just got incorporated by our own presentation of the order by our own lawyers. And so I would hope that the questions that are being asked of the search firm, the first questions that should be asked of candidates are, do you follow instructions rather than your own agenda? And do you take seriously your obligation to communicate with your client in a timely manner and an effective manner? Because that is, as to this particular matter, was not done. And Mike Moran, who happens to be a former U.S. Supreme Court clerk, fully agreed with that statement at the recent CARD meeting, and I think there needs to be some serious questions asked about why the action was taken by the city attorney and outside counsel. And that's my comment for tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Doobie doobie.
And I think that that's everyone, correct, Kathy?
That is correct. There are no more hands up.
Well, you know, I will echo Kathy's call for support or not support or ideas on caucus. Please let us know if you'd like to continue this throughout the summer. I know July 4th is on a Sunday. I don't know if we're going to have caucus on that Sunday. So we know that. So there will be, you know, caucus in 2 weeks. I know it's a big commitment, and it really does alter our plans on Sundays to come and do this. But to this point, I do feel big value in doing it. And hopefully there is enough support and enough participation to warrant the continuation.
And I just want to say I am totally committed to a caucus-like activity and being available to my constituents. However, I feel that the caucus process that we have right now has somewhat been taken over, and there are many misstatements that are made, and we don't have an opportunity to correct them. And so I believe that we are simply contributing to disinformation in many cases, and I would like to figure out a way to be able to have a dialogue with other council members and with the community without that negative overhead. And just one example is that Council Member Hayner has been viciously attacked over and over again with false information. I don't mind accurately describing what happened and holding him accountable, but we need to connect the dots in terms of who are the players here. Are they politically motivated, or are they truly people who feel wronged? And I'm having a serious problem, a serious, serious problem trying to deal with this and to explain to constituents, this is a major embarrassment for council and for our community to play dirty politics the way we have. And there'll be more information coming out that will put all of this in perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy. I know we're running late, but you know, it would be unfortunate that incident or incidences like that would cause the collateral damage to not allow for an opportunity like this, reach out and speak with us in an informal way. I don't know if I know we can't control what happens, what other people do with what we say. I mean, that's just living in this modern world today, where it's the age of misinformation, and that's the world we live in. And whether it's caucus or something else, it's a world of misinformation. We saw that starting in the 2016 election. And it's just picked up more and more steam because, unfortunately, it's effective for the folks that use it. I hope it does not cause this to be a victim of what happened with it. So I appreciate everyone spending their day with us. I know the hot, steamy one. We got a big agenda tomorrow. Thanks for the ideas and the engagement. I do support what folks did say, like Sam, who say I think more beneficial to have a give and take back and forth during this meeting and not just spewing it one way. And that I don't know if it has value for the public with that setup. So appreciate everyone being here. It really was a pleasure. Have a good night.
Goodbye.